Hey, Matthew.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
Good, good. So, Matthew Lee, who just had an excellent write-up in the New York Times about his blog, Inner City Press, you're the only accredited blogger within the UN, is that correct?
It's not correct.
It's actually. Not correct.
There's another, the New York Times. I mean, I wouldn't, in the sense of, there are certainly people here who write for online publications
yeah.
or write some for print. I mean, I write some for print. So it's sort of, I understand that they sort of wanted to make
yeah.
it. I think what they were saying is that it's not so much like who's a blogger. It's that you're writing online, as I'm sure you've said, you can cover topics that don't necessarily give rise to like 700
yeah.
words in the New York Times, but they're still worth doing in a kind of a smart-ass way.
It's true. Well,
and that's what they don't like.
I guess we operate in a similar universe. I write the blog mm-hmm. undispatch.org, or
sure,
pardon me,
I've seen
.com, which is sponsored by the United Nations Foundation, but I should say as a disclaimer, I speak
sure.
for myself. We at UN Dispatch cover the UN, but not from the bowels of the UN like you, so I think we have a different perspective a bit.
That's probably true. So I think both are needed. You could be too, like, inside the bubble here.
You know? Well, you provide an excellent service. So news of the day, first things first, Kurt Waldheim, Secretary General from 1972 to 1982, died today. What's been the reaction like inside the halls there?
Is that you shedding a tear that I hear?
I wouldn't exactly shed it. I don't think he's very lamented. For those who don't know Kurt Waldheim, after he finished his second term as Secretary General, ran for President of Austria and won. But in the campaign, it turned out that he had a much more active Nazi past than was previously known. And I actually read an interesting article in Haaretz today that talked about the impact of his presidency on Austria's willingness to face its own responsibility for World War II and the Holocaust. Right. I guess there was a myth that they were the first victim of Hitler, whereas
right.
the Waldheim presidency showed that, in fact, they're a bit more complicit than particularly acknowledged.
I think there's even a theory that some countries on the permanent five knew of this past and used it to keep him in line.
But really?
That's a whole nother, yes.
Is that okay.
Which is sort of, but here, I can say factually here, it did, you know, obviously the news came out in the morning.
Yeah.
They have like a, you know, the squawk box system. They said, you know, now in the spokesman's office is a statement by the Secretary Ban Ki-moon
yeah.
on the passing of Kurt Waldheim. There had previously, earlier this year, there was a bit of if it was a scandal or not, but when Ban Ki-moon went to Europe, he met with Kurt Waldheim. I don't know if you knew that. He had dinner with Kurt Waldheim, and there was a lot of, and so it gave rise to a lot of sarcastic and skeptical questions at the time. And they ended up saying, like people said, like, what's the readout of the meeting? What
mm-hmm.
did you meet with him about? And they ended up saying, sticking to their guns and saying it was a private meeting
okay.
because when Ban Ki-moon was foreign minister of South Korea, he'd met him in that capacity and therefore visited
right.
him.
Well, fair enough. Yeah.
yeah. No, it was fair enough.
Yeah.
But I think it was. I think they should have expected to have the question.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I mean, it was
yeah.
not. And so even today, I would say most, at least in the public, I mean, some media that just have to cover it as a straight news event were just wanting to get, like, old footage
yeah.
or somebody in the UN system who could be quoted. Print media that had more freedom to sort of let it all hang out
yeah.
were asking questions like, you know, are the flags going to be down? Is any sort of like looking to see how the UN would sort of acknowledge without openly acknowledging in this time of grief,
yeah.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The issue. And nobody, there really has been none of that. In fact, right at the end of the day, they put out on the squawk system that tomorrow at 10 a.m. in the General Assembly, there'll be a remembrance.
Yeah.
The flags will all be down, you know.
Mm.
There'll be a lot of sarcastic and skeptical people tomorrow.
Well, I guess
and I don't say it with any disrespect to, you know, the Waldheim family.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I guess his like triumph, at least, as Secretary General was the Iranian hostage crisis. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
He helped secure the release of, was it 13 Americans in 81?
Yep. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's sort of strange. Is it's
mm-hmm.
kind of, but that obviously, you know,
mm-hmm.
when you're outed on your Nazi past,
yeah.
it does tend to cast
it
a pall.
It does. I mean, it will certainly be in his obituary, that's for sure.
Right. And the question, I think what people are watching here, and again, it's micro, and I wonder if it'll actually be memorialized in any print media, I mean, you know, hard copy print media, is how is, you know, how would the UN, you know, it's all like in code language, but there probably is a way to say, you know, I don't know if you can do it the day the person dies, but to say nothing and pretend like the stuff that came out never came out.
Yeah.
yeah. looks kind of.
Well, I haven't seen much press that's been covering it up. I mean, it's, you know, it's
right.
It's,
no, no. Yeah. What I mean is here at the UN tomorrow. The question will be: there'll be member states giving speeches in the GA.
That's true.
And the question is, who will? I hopefully, and I don't say this like will Dan Gilliman of Israel come?
That's true. That's true. I guess we'll see tomorrow. You'll have to let me know. We'll read InterCity Press to find out.
I will actually be in the GA.
We'll link to you and we'll read you.
Okay.
And likewise. Great. So lots to cover. Lots of UN news these days. Now, I guess you do a bit of muckraking yourself.
Sure. No, I've been covering the UN. Tell me how you want to do it. There definitely is a lot of UN news. I was going to say again on the sort of this is not muckraking, but just kind of press watch from here in the belly of it.
Yeah.
There, I will say, and this is the television broadcast media.
Yes.
Would say that although I mean there's two ways to measure like. You know, UN news, and like I would say it by like, wow, you know, is the Security Council meeting about Darfur or about Iran? Then that's a lot of news.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with you've been covering a bit this issue of the United Nations Development Program in North Korea.
Sure.
And I guess we can start with that now. For I think our viewers who might be as attuned to this. We can discuss a bit of the background of what this issue is, but from an outsider, outside the UN, looking in, I read in January a Wall Street Journal op-ed piece alleging hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud with the United Nations Development Program, which is a UN agency that provides humanitarian assistance and all sorts of relief work within countries like North Korea and other developing countries around the world. And what I read was that the UNDP was kicking money, hard currency, to the regime of Kim Jong-il, and the Wall Street Journal op-ed page, never a friend of the United Nations, said this is the new oil for food, this is cash for Kim is what they called it. Mm-hmm. And I read subsequently that, in fact, over the last 3 years, or the last 9 years, UNDP expenditures within North Korea amount to only about $2 to $3 million a year, and that these expenditures go for kind of normal things like renting local office space or hiring local staff, which the UNDP, as well as embassies around the world, need to do, and that the scandal, as it were, comes from the fact that the UNDP is providing North Korea with this hard currency. And sorry to get a little more complicated, the hard currency ends up in sort of Kim Jong-il's coffers, as it were, in two ways. Either it needs to get, either foreign currency is paid directly to local authorities, or it's converted through a bank, through a national bank, which in a country like North Korea means someone like Kim Jong-il will probably get a cut. Now, to me, this doesn't seem like the next oil for food or really even much of a big scandal, and I'm wondering if you think
I'm
wrong.
Let me tell you. I'll preface it by saying for what it's worth, just as InterCity Press had been covering UNDP and some issues there before the North Korea thing came out. So it's not – and I sort of brought I'll talk about that later. I want to on the quote cash for Kim scandal.
Yeah.
It's a bit more. I mean, it's more. I myself am at heart, you know, skeptical of kind of like, you know, leaks from the U.S. mission to the Wall Street Journal or to Fox News or whatever.
Yes.
But in this case, I mean, I think what you've said is pretty much the way that UNDP has described it as a relatively small program as hard currency would make a difference. The reality is that I think maybe the simplest way to get to the heart of it is that, unlike in almost every other country in the world, the local staff of UNDP was all given to them by the government.
Okay.
Like there was no vetting of CVs. There was no choosing. The government said these are the people you're going to hire.
Yeah.
And UNDP took them. Okay.
Yeah.
Beyond that, their salary. It's not whether you call it hard currency or soft. Their salary wasn't paid to the employee. The salary was paid to the government.
Yes.
Who in turn was supposed to pay it to the employee, but by all accounts did not. Because the salary also involves a separate this meal allowance that is paid directly to the employee. And so you ask yourself, just commonsensically, why would an employer make sure to give, like, food directly to its local employees if it had any confidence that the cash it gave to the government was going to the going to
okay,
people?
I guess.
Now, the thing is, it's still the amount at issue.
It's pretty small, right? It's just salaries of local employees.
Here's the thing, though. The difference is that UNDP, the UN Development Program, is the resident coordinator and makes payments on behalf of almost every other UN agency in countries like North Korea.
Let me interrupt.
That is true.
Does that include UNICEF?
That includes UNICEF.
Okay.
That includes FAO. Yes, they are the ones making the payments. And so I think initially when you saw David Morrison, the spokesman of UNDP, saying it's only $2 to $3 million a year, and you had not just there was a Chicago Tribune story that came out later that jacked up the numbers. I don't think the initial Wall Street Journal story really came out with a hard number. The Chicago Tribune, a reporter called Bei Fang, wrote a story saying $150 million.
Okay.
Now, the question is, on one hand, you have somebody saying three a year, and then you have a newspaper saying 150.
So I guess, sorry, just to back up.
Sure.
So the scandal, I guess, is that North Korea was deciding which employees the UNDP and UN agencies could
hire and taking all their
salaries.
Yeah, I mean the idea that basically, the allegation would be that North Korea, because the world as a whole wants to help North Korea.
Yes.
I mean, like WFP. I mean, particularly the other thing to say about UNDP is it's not they themselves would bristle at being called a humanitarian agency. What they do is not humanitarian; it's development.
Yes.
They distinguish it. They say, you know, WFP delivers food. UNICEF tries to help kids.
Yeah.
UNDP is all about building the capacity of government.
I think that's
why they become such a target. It's not a target because it raises the question. Like, it's one thing to say, there are a lot of questions being raised here about their involvement in Zimbabwe, for example.
Okay.
Because it's one thing for WFP to say, people are starving in Zimbabwe, let's deliver food.
Yes.
But where UNDP's model of development is to build the capacity of governments to do development themselves. But what do you do when the government that they're in
is a
dictatorial government? Go ahead.
I guess, but you're also saying that they're dispersing money on behalf of other agencies which are more, which have larger expenditures within North Korea,
definitely.
Like UNICEF, which are a bit more strictly humanitarian. I guess I've 2 points or questions. One is that I guess on maybe a philosophical level, probably the executive committee of UNDP, which organizes UNDP's work. Someone made, a decision that I guess the price of doing business in North Korea was that they had to oblige North Koreans' demands that they hire certain local staff. If they didn't do that, I guess UNICEF and UNDP and all these other humanitarian agencies that feed people in North Korea, that, you know, inoculate children, would just be kicked out of the country. And I guess they made a decision that it's better to, you know, play by these rules and deliver our services to the people of North Korea despite having to deal with a terrible regime like Kim Jong-il's. But I guess the people who made this decision were the executive committee, which are composed of member states of the United Nations, including, you know, the United States, which raised these allegations and these questions in the first place. Why didn't the executive committee just put a stop to it when they wanted to?
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, believe it or not, the executive board, as Chance would have it, is meeting here this week.
Okay.
It's like a 2-week meeting. And having attended some, I mean, one thing to be said is that there's not a whole lot of debate at this. Like, I've heard UNDP say that, like, how can you criticize us?
Yeah,
our executive board approved it.
Exactly.
I attended 6 months ago a 2-week UNDP executive board meeting, and there was virtually no discussion from the floor, and there are documents given out and just approved on. And so I don't, again, I'm not trying to say, and in fact, it may be member states' own fault if they didn't look more closely. But here's the thing, the one other thing, and I think that this is what kind of gave rise to the whole scandal, alleged scandal, okay?
Yes, please,
that beginning last fall in, like, November, but then very strongly in December, the U.S. approached UNDP, the U.S. mission to the United Nations.
Mark Wallace,
and said, absolutely, and said, please show us these internal audits that you had done of your programs in North Korea. It was done by KPMG.
Yes.
Now we've seen the audits, but these audits existed. There was one done in 2001, mm-hmm. 2004. The United States, which is on the executive board
yes.
and has given a lot of money to UNDP, asked to see the audit.
Yes.
And UNDP said no.
Okay, well.
And that's become, and they have a reason, too. I mean, I know that I don't want to, it may seem disingenuous for me to try to, but their reason is these are management audits that are quite critical sometimes.
Okay.
That they're good for management to read about the problems, but they don't necessarily
okay.
want them made public. The other argument, though, is if the countries that are giving all the money, not just the U.S., Japan is actually, it doesn't come out in the press coverage, Japan is the one that basically said to UNDP, close the program.
Okay.
Now, they obviously have their own politics of having missiles
yeah.
launched at them,
mm-hmm.
but they're in the meeting in January, the country that was more aggressive was Japan. And in fact, there's maybe we can move beyond. I mean, we can keep going on this, but interesting in terms of UN politics, there's now a memo that got leaked out by the UN's Department of Political mm-hmm. Affairs, saying it's unclear sort of how it's a draft memo.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty well put together piece of work, and it says it's written to Ban Ki-moon, presenting him with three options of what the UN should do about North Korea, and it's very much recommending that he become more involved in the six-party talks, that the UN has a role to play. But it only has that role to play if UNDP is still doing business in North Korea. And so it's hoped. This thing came out in April. It's dated April.
Okay.
It was hoped that the audit, when it came out, would allay the concerns and allow UNDP to go back.
Matthew, I
know it's getting way too...
I think you and I find this fascinating. I know
sure.
you find this fascinating.
No, we can...
I think maybe other people don't.
No,
which is
definitely.
A shame
no,
because,
I
mean, you know... Yeah, I
guess I just want to highlight that as a reason
that
people may have. I've seen coverage that tried to say, well, there was an audit and UNDP has been exonerated. And let me say this from the outset.
Yeah.
I'm skeptical of the U.S. mission's motive even in asking for the audits. I believe that at the time they began this inquiry, it was the policy of the Bush administration to squeeze Kim Jong-il, to bring him to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Now, strangely enough, now they're trying to... You know, they really have taken a different approach. Something changed, and they're trying to give them the $25 million, even though they said it was dirty money. And so I just want to say that if covering it quite closely, it's almost strange that the U.S. itself might walk away from these very a basic issue, which is that should a U.N. agency that takes money from member states provide virtually all of its documents upon request to the
mm-hmm.
member states that give the money? And number two, and it is reasonable minds totally disagree on whether UN agencies, how closely they should engage with, you know, questionably democratic, arguably despotic regimes. And that's, I know some very good humanitarians that are like, we have to help people.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be blamed for living mm-hmm. under a dictator. And that's fair. You know?
Well, we'll trust you'll keep following this.
Right. No, yeah.
So I guess moving around the world, did you have a chance, actually I'm sure you did you have a chance to see the end of mission memo by Alvaro da Silva?
Sure.
I guess we should give a bit of background here. Alvaro da Silva was the UN's top guy in the Israeli-Palestine peace process in some of the most critical months from 2005, I guess, until last week. And he wrote this really fascinating and in-depth memo about the UN peace process, about the peace process and the UN's role and the quartet's role in it as sort of a goodbye letter to the UN as also as advice to the person coming to succeed him.
Sure.
I found it was pretty scathing, I thought, against the United States at points, particularly in that critical moment after the Hamas elections, after the elections in the Palestinian territories that elected a Hamas government. And I guess da Silva saw this as an opening, that now that you have Hamas in there, we have an opportunity to co-opt them into the peace process, whereas the United States was not having that. And there's this one point in the memo that da Silva writes in which he's in a meeting with David Welch, who's the State Department's top guy on the Palestine-Israel peace process, and Elliot Abrams of Iran-Contra fame, who was also in the meeting, and they sort of they browbeat De Silva and into making sure that the UN would have a review of all their programs to make sure that, you know, all money to Hamas to the Palestinian territories would dry up. They you know, wanted to play hardball, and now, you know, we have a civil war going on in the Palestinian territories right now.
Mm-hmm. No, it was that caused a big the release of that memo, which was a very, you know, I think everyone has said it was a very candid and well thought out
and well written, I should say. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, he's a very guy. I mean, he actually was here yesterday.
Yeah.
In another capacity, like moderating something about Central America,
okay.
He used to be their envoy to, like, in the
80s. Sorry, he's a Peruvian. If I'm correct.
Absolutely, he's actually the brother of the economist Humberto de Soto. His name's
okay.
De Soto, and he's the brother of that famous sort of semi-right wing economist that was with a big Ronald Reagan was a big fan of this libertarian.
Okay.
Anyway, but this is the thing I can add to, like, what's been, you know, the Guardian essentially got the memo, put it online, people can read it. It's a very candid and well informed view of the domination of U.S. policy by the U.S.
Yeah.
Essentially. But what was interesting here yesterday was the incredibly defensive way in which the Ban Ki-moon administration responded to the memo. Like, it's not unheard of in any government to have this type of policy document get leaked to a newspaper.
Yeah.
But they literally, this is, I guess now it's Thursday, on Tuesday at 6 o'clock, the spokesman's office here had already gotten a call from the Guardian newspaper saying, what's your comment on the memo? And they'd said, you know, it's unfortunate it was leaked. There was circulated to all of the staff of the UN this memo from Ban Ki-moon saying, I am extremely troubled by leaks.
Mm-hmm.
We must tighten up the show.
I mean, isn't that a fairly predictable response? You know,
I think what people have said is it's not surprising, and he's totally within his rights to say.
I mean,
I think what people would have expected.
And bloggers, I love leaks.
the difference, I think, is that here's one thing. Like, you wouldn't see, I hate to say it, George Bush put his name on a memo. Like, people said, why did, you know, to do it himself and to not, the memo doesn't distinguish between don't release draft documents because they hurt diplomacy. It says don't release sensitive communications, and it's signed by him, and it makes no, given a lot of the things that are said at the UN about the desire for transparency, the protection of whistleblowers, if you read this memo, there's no carve-out for a whistleblower. It basically says, I don't like things that make the UN look bad being released, don't release them. May think that this is.
That doesn't seem like shocking to me.
It seemed kind of tone deaf to people because we've just had in this same week, and I'm not talking, I'm looking for trouble, but we just had this, you know, the conviction of this guy Sanjay Bahel in for a procurement scandal. People may not put all these issues together, but the press corps here, we all went to an hour long press conference by the head of auditing, the Southern District convicted this guy, and what everyone at the UN has said is, now we're going to be transparent. That case was only brought about because of a whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
So when you read a memo that goes out that doesn't, all I'm saying is, with the whole history to this, probably a better, maybe they just moved fast because they were so angry.
Yeah.
But literally, I think you're going to see, even the press called the spokeswoman on it the next day and said, you know, what is this saying to employees? Not just because we as journalists like leaks.
Yeah.
Right? But it's true, given, you know, most, the Mr., you know, maybe I'm shifting this, but when Ban Ki-moon ran for the post that he now has as Secretary General, he said, we're going to be at the highest level of integrity and transparency. And part of that, not just at the UN, but anywhere, means you don't just tell people, you know, you better not tell information that makes us look bad to the press, or we'll crack down on you. Because then what about a whistleblower?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this case, it wasn't a whistleblower. Who knows who released it? Some people speculate that De Soto did. I don't believe that because he looked pretty angry about it, too.
I mean, it's well written.
If you wrote something like that, want it to go, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to provide a different – but it is, I think, a lot of – and I'll just – not for the purposes of being controversial. What some people say, well, why would Ban Ki-moon and team be so upset by this memo?
Mm-hmm. Well,
now there is no political process there. It's not like it's going to upset the current civil war between Hamas and Fatah, but that it upset the U.S. that makes them look bad.
The memo clearly makes U.S. diplomacy look pretty terrible in Gaza, and you know, I assume, I don't know, but I guess Ban Ki-moon was thinking that he doesn't want to give the impression that the UN is trashing U.S. diplomacy
totally.
In the Middle East.
And I also think he disagrees.
Fight the hand that feeds you here. Yeah, and I
he disagrees with that memo. I think that he went out of his way to tell all, you know, just as an aside, it's a pretty small press corps here. Like, we all know each other.
Yeah.
And, like, so he came and did a stakeout, and all of us were there. And he almost made this impassioned plea. Like, he's upset by the skeptical and negative tone of the coverage because the quartet is getting a lot. The thing that Alvaro de Soto called a sideshow in his memo.
Yeah.
Ban Ki-moon was like, it's not a sideshow. He used the word. He's like, it's not a sideshow. And, you know, so I think he was beyond just being troubled by leaks. He doesn't agree with that memo, and he didn't just say no comment. He said, I don't agree with that.
Well, he seems to be something of an optimist, which I guess is a good trait to have in a diplomat. And,
absolutely.
You know, there has been some optimism this week about progress in Darfur as well.
Right. I don't know if there's been any optimism about Gaza, but there's certainly.
I think
that things have gotten so bad there that it's maybe that's why the De Soto memo gets play because it's sort of self.
But again, yeah, big news week for the UN in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia this week. Representatives from the African Union and the United Nations and the Sudanese government and other international actors finally announced that. Khartoum had agreed to let UN peacekeepers into Darfur. And a bit of background here, the Security Council authorized a fairly robust force for Darfur of about 22,000 strong back in August 31st. But they haven't been able to get those peacekeepers into Western Sudan yet because Khartoum has blocked their deployment. And so news is, I guess, that a deal has been reached in which the Khartoum has relented and are going to let peacekeepers into Darfur. Now, I'm actually quite skeptical of this news. I've followed Darfur pretty closely. And it seems that Khartoum has made these overtures in the past, and about almost each and every time they have backed off from previous promises to let peacekeepers into Darfur. So, you know, I guess we'll wait and see, but in the meantime, I'm not all that optimistic. And I know the U.S. Ambassador, Khalilzad, said today, you know, it looks like there are conditions upon the deployment that Khartoum only agreed to let African Union troops into Darfur and also demanded that the African Union take the lead in the mission, which would create terrible logistical problems that might actually retard the deployment as well.
No, absolutely. That's exactly. And that this was could have been seen. And that's also, I mean, just to follow on your skepticism on this one.
Yeah.
That's what some people, it's good to be optimistic, but it's not good. I mean, frankly, Ban Ki-moon has made about four, since he became Secretary General almost 6 months ago, like four times, he's like, we've made the big breakthrough. Everything is solved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten to the point where even the press corps here is like,
okay,
you've said this before. And everyone knew they gave us a background briefing. We're not supposed to say who it was, from a senior UN official leading up to the Addis Ababa thing. And he said, well, you know, we've rewritten, there's this agreement that was all the AU, UN, and the al-Bashir government of Sudan were all going to agree to. It actually was sort of watered down. And we were told, the press corps was told, that there's some secret documents, technical documents, that show that the UN will really have command, you know?
Okay.
Unity. And because that all become, the thing is that would troop contributing countries, give troops if they don't have any control over them? The reality is they won't.
Yeah.
And so that's the real, even, I guess what I'm saying is that even leading up to this, before they said he's agreed to the document, people looked at the document and said, this document is just a setup for problems down the road because it allows him to say, as he said, only African troops.
I think this raises an interesting point about the UN as a whole when in responding to crises like this. You know, I, from my sense, I think the General Secretariat of the UN has done a lot has really pushed the envelope and is trying to do the right thing in Darfur. But at this point, they have no power entrusted to them. You know, Ban Ki-moon can't snap his fingers and raise an army. He depends on member states to apply the requisite bilateral pressure on Khartoum to make them feel that peacekeepers in Darfur are really an offer they can't refuse. And it's that kind of pressure from countries like the United States and China and the European Union that's lacking, and it's that kind of inability, I think, among the United States and other members of the permanent five in the Security Council to make Darfur a top foreign policy priority. There is no pressure on Khartoum, and you know Ban Ki-moon doesn't have intrinsic power to him. He relies mm-hmm. on powerful member states to give him that pressure, and you know I feel like he's almost being set up for failure here. Mm-hmm. He announces a deal, and yes, it's a deal, but you got to have you know George Bush or Hu Jintao like telling Khartoum to accept this deal and making it clear that if they don't, consequences will follow. But that's just not happening.
No, I think that that's a lot. It's actually worth the there is this. People say the UN and they don't distinguish between you know the secretary, the secretariat and all the people that work under the Secretary General and peacekeeping. And then you know obviously it's the Security Council that votes for these things.
It is
what most you know.
Yeah.
What most people would and I'm almost thinking I think probably you know some of our viewers. There's a history here. You think of like Rwanda.
Yeah.
You think of like of various times in which the UN has been criticized for not taking action.
Yeah.
And the reality is that the body that didn't take action was the Security Council.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They were in the case of Rwanda, as many people that you know when you read up on it, the US and like sad to say, Madeleine Albright, they were adamant that the UN were not going to vote to send in troops to Rwanda because they just lost American soldiers in Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's And it's the same thing. I mean, here, obviously, and a lot of people have said that Sudan believes that its ultimate support against just a kind of a unilateral decision by the Security Council to send in troops to protect the people of Darfur.
Yes.
This would require the all permanent five countries, U.S., U.K., France, China, and Russia, all voting to, you know, invoke what's called Chapter 7, which allows the UN to do something without the permission of the host country.
Yes.
And you know, China's not going to veto that.
Well,
that's clear. So we're working around.
I guess logistically speaking, troop-contributing countries, particularly like India, Pakistan, China, they're not going to volunteer their troops for a mission tantamount to the invasion of Sudan.
But a controversial point is why didn't the U.S. I mean, I just think, you know, the U.S. says that Darfur is central to its foreign policy, is a crucial issue to it, right?
Yes.
And I know it's apples and oranges, but the U.S., look, when it wanted to invade Iraq, it didn't wait for UN approval. It just did it.
Sure.
Obviously, they viewed it as more directly implicating U.S. interests.
Well, but I guess.
I'm not at all saying the U.S. should invade the Sudan, but I'm just saying where the U.S. has seen something as being important, they don't care
about
what the U.N. says. But in this case, they're blaming the U.N.
The more proximate example would be the Kosovo operation of NATO, which was done outside, beyond the Security Council's jurisdiction. They didn't vote for it.
Correct. Yeah. No, exactly. No, that's and again, I'm not at all saying that it also would be but it is. I sometimes when I see particularly the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
administration blaming the U.N. for
yes.
its inaction on Darfur, you have to scratch your head and say like you know.
That's the thing. The U.N. becomes a scapegoat for things like this, wherein the real power lies with powerful countries like the United States. But our diplomacy is a bit towards Sudan has been a bit more accommodating than coercive.
Right. No. Sure. I mean, and the thing is, I mean, what you hear a lot here, and I think people mm-hmm. It takes a while for you know civil society and George Clooney and Don Cheadle and all whatnot to get revved up, and so now I would say that the movement to quote save Darfur is peaking now. Mm-hmm. What people as respected as Jan Eliasson or Eliasson, however you want to pronounce it, who is a long-term UN diplomat, is the head of the General Assembly. He and even this guy Andrew Natsios of the U.S. thing, they're saying the actual level of government on civilian violence in Darfur currently is less than it was in 2004.
Well, I think
it's almost politically incorrect to say that because then it seems like you're a defender of al-Bashir, but that's the reality. These are people he's a straight shooter.
Yes.
So it's kind of weird. You have this, it's a little bit out of kilter. There was a time in which all that was going on there was the government cracking down on a rebellious province and trying to kill civilians.
Yes.
Now it's a lot more complicated, but the demand to save Darfur from al-Bashir is peaking now, and so it's.
I would make two points. One, I think perhaps the best way to describe the condition on the ground in Darfur is not genocide as we traditionally know it, but more of a genocide by attrition, which is a term coined by Eric Reeves, who's a Sudan analyst. In that, you know, the government of Khartoum is putting up these obstacles, these bureaucratic obstacles to allowing humanitarian assistance to their own people in their western province. Secondly, I'd actually say that the movement to save Darfur peaked earlier. Mm-hmm. I think it peaked in April 2006. And again, we might be getting a little too inside baseball here. But in April 2006, the seven members of the Save Darfur coalition met President Bush in the White House. Mm-hmm. And 2 days later, there was a big rally on the Mall with, you know, George Clooney and all the celebrities. But then 2 days after that, Robert Zoellick, now the World Bank president, was deputy secretary of state and in charge of the Sudan portfolio, and went to Abuja, Nigeria, to oversee negotiations in a Darfur peace agreement. And frankly, the U.S. was not about to give high-level attention to this Darfur peace process, I think, until these activists made their plea to the president. I think they actually helped dislodge some resistance by the administration to get involved with this.
Sure. No. I think absolutely. Yeah. That's very good. I guess I'm seeing it as here, where the sort of, and it may also be with, you know, there are calls now for boycotting the Beijing Olympics because China is viewed as being very close to Sudan. So I see that as sort of peaking. But all I'll say is that, and it may even seem, I know that, I don't know what the politics of this are, but the well-meaning and well-informed UN people that study, you know, I'm thinking in particular of Jan Eliasson, who came back from there.
Yeah.
He's now the envoy with this guy Salim of the AU. You know, he said both publicly and then in more detail on sort of in other contexts here that it's a two-sided if the quote rebels in Darfur, if there's no pressure on them to stop, you know, whatever, carjacking humanitarian workers.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the questions becomes, not to be politically incorrect, but who's been arming the rebels of Darfur? Not that it should be, maybe they should be armed. I mean, if the government was killing civilians, arm them.
Well,
but I've heard a plea from well-informed UN people that pressure needs to be brought to bear not only to al-Bashir, but to the rebels.
I think that's kind of
lacking in some of the sometimes the way it's portrayed. I'm not a defender of the al-Bashir government.
Oh, sure,
at all.
Sure, yeah.
But I think, I mean, I don't know who is, really, frankly. But I think that it can be kind of portrayed in a simplistic way that it doesn't help to solve it if you view it in a kind of a cartoon of cartoons.
Yes.
In which there's a terrible
cartoon characters. Yes.
Yeah, cartoon characters. It's sort of, he is a key, I mean, it's really a plague on both their houses, because these, honestly, a lot of the rebel groups in Darfur, the reason that humanitarian workers can't get in there right now is more to do with the, quote, rebels or just gangsterism than the government.
Yeah, I mean, there's no security. But, again, you rely on a government to provide security.
No, sure, absolutely.
It's not there.
But if you pass sanctions and say they can't bring troops in, they can't fly there, I mean, you're in a weird position where you're the government that's held accountable for not providing security.
Yeah.
But if you send your security forces there, you're accused of genocide. I mean, people need to think. I think it's a very – I mean, this is a government that clearly was willing to do outrageous things.
There's a way of conducting a counterinsurgency that doesn't include genocide, and I think that's – no, that's the where maybe Khartoum went wrong, but I guess let's moving on. Let's talk about other peacekeeping. It's actually a subject I've been writing a lot about on UN Dispatch recently. Mm-hmm. Specifically, I've been sort of trying to highlight or talk about this what I've written, at least in the American Prospect as well, is might be a coming peacekeeping crunch. That the demand for peacekeeping around the world is actually outpacing the supply in terms of military resources and economic resources to get new peacekeeping missions off the ground and sustain existing ones. I mean, in the last 6 to 9 months, the demand, there's been new calls for peacekeepers in Lebanon, in Darfur, which is not off the ground, East Timor. We talk about Chad, Somalia, maybe the Central African Republic, and you have this explosion of peacekeeping, but the sort of the staff at the UN must be overwhelmed. I mean, there are over 100,000 peacekeepers around the world, managed by like maybe 475 staff. At the UN, and it's you know, there's this recipe for disaster that's brewing. And added on top of this is the fact that the United States, the government most that's assessed the greatest amount of contributions to pay for peacekeeping. Peacekeeping, I should say, is paid for through contributions from member states that are assessed on a economy scale basis, with the U.S. paying the most at 27%. But the U.S. is consistently pays less than that amount, and the United States has accumulated significant arrears. And I think if these arrears aren't paid, and if new funds aren't made available, peacekeeping could break.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we're on exactly the same page on
that. Yeah.
I mean, I think there are some critiques of making UN peacekeeping work better.
Yes.
But in terms of the U.S. playing cheap with it, it does things that nobody else wants to do.
Yeah.
And it does it. I read a book, actually, the title's escaping me right now, that makes a very clear comparison of sort of costs, you know, really looking at, like, costs of, like, different models of peacekeeping, right? Because you can do it different ways.
Well,
there's been a force in. I mean, you can do it through NATO. You can look at the cost of the U. You know, you can't call that peacekeeping, but the U.S. occupation of Iraq is something else.
Well, I should actually say, for a point of comparison,
please,
what the UN spends on peacekeeping in a year, about $6 billion, is the equivalent of what the United States spends in Iraq in a month.
Yep. Exactly. And they're everywhere, and they're all over the world, and they're it's incredible, you know?
You were talking about the cost of peacekeeping. I remember a government accounting office report compared the hypothetical cost of an American occupation of Haiti to the UN peacekeeping force there, and found that the UN achieves the same results, if not better, being 8 times less expensive. I remember as well reading in James Traub's book, The Best of Intentions, a almost biography of Kofi Annan. He has a passage in which he quotes Condoleezza Rice speaking to Kofi Annan, saying, "You know, if there weren't 6,000 Brazilians in Haiti, there'd be 6,000 Marines." And they obviously don't have Marines to spare at this point. So there's a burden sharing role, I think, that UN peacekeeping does. It's not appreciated, at least among the American public. Foreign policy elites may note it. Congress actually certainly doesn't, because they consistently underfund peacekeeping.
Right. No, I think in terms of the U.S. paying its dues, I know we're on the same page. The one thing I do want to say, just because being here and sort of like literally whether you're looking for it or not, like clockwork, and not necessarily from what would be considered kind of right-wing gotcha media.
Yeah.
Like, the BBC recently did a very well-researched expose of, within the UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, a Pakistani battalion, which, by all accounts, and by BBC having sent reporters and getting people by name on radio saying, was involved in trading gold and guns with militia leaders. So that doesn't discredit the whole, and I don't think that the people in the U.S. Congress that don't want to pay the dues, really, they would just be using that.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, that did happen, and I think there is the kind of policy issue. It's not a U.S. issue. It's an international law issue.
No, I agree.
Is that the U.N. sends these battalions. Generally, I mean, people should know the main troop contributing countries are like Pakistan, Bangladesh,
India,
Nepal, Fiji, I mean, obviously Brazil, but it's a lot of, and the problem is that the UN doesn't really have control over them, in the sense that if crimes occur, as are alleged in the case of Pakistan, even in Kosovo, there was the firing of some 14-year-old rubber bullets that had hardened, and so they killed protesters.
Yeah.
The peacekeepers just, the most the UN can do, the UN can't do anything if the peacekeepers say, "I'm going back to my country."
Yeah.
Now, the UN counts on the country
to prosecute,
doing some kind of a legal proceeding, but it rarely happens. And then the UN doesn't complain because
it needs
a crunch. It's not just how to manage the 100,000. As Jean-Marie Guénot, the head of peacekeeping, says, there's probably a demand for 120,000 in a year's time. And so somebody needs to solve. And it's hard because you want to make it easier for countries to give troops.
Yeah.
But if the UN I almost don't blame the UN, as they often say, if you have 100,000 troops, you're going to have some bad apples.
Sure.
But in the U.S. Army, if people in Japan or South Korea, when a UN troop goes, a U.S. troop goes crazy, they don't like it.
Yeah.
But the U.S. has an ability to discipline the person.
Well, that's the thing. We have our uniform code of military justice.
Correct.
The problem is, it's a bit harder for a multinational organization like the UN to create something like that, only because I can't imagine, for the reasons you just described, but also I can't imagine member states like the United States or China or other countries granting the United Nations the ability to prosecute their own citizens. So, for example,
the U.S. hardly gives any peace.
Well, exactly.
But I agree. It still holds
principle. On principle, I don't think the U.S. would ever accede to that notion, which is, again, ties the U.N.'s hands here.
But it seems like, and it's not an easy problem to solve, but it strikes me that probably in the wake of one of these scandals, and they have been pretty, they come out like clockwork.
Yeah.
And we always get a briefing by a person who's not supposed to be named from the Department of Peacekeeping Services who says, never again, zero tolerance.
Yeah.
But and a lot of times the allegations are sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Right?
Also
in the Congo, the trading of eggs and peanut butter for sex for underage Congolese.
Yeah.
But it seems like these memorandums of understanding between the troop contributing countries and the UN, they probably could say, minor discipline, it's on the country.
Yeah.
But in cases of alleged, rape, you know what I mean?
You
could say, is consensual, you're going to have these disputes, is it a rape case or not? But it doesn't seem, there literally is a kind of a pattern of some of the worst abuses not being prosecuted back in the home country. Like now, the gold and gun trading, it's totally unclear, even if it's taken 2 years for the UN to investigate.
Yeah.
And some people say the reason that the report has been sort of buried is because the UN has no motivation to release a report saying a major troop contributing country, Pakistan, had a battalion that traded golden guns in the Congo.
Yeah.
Because they need tens of thousands of Pakistani peacekeepers next year.
They need the troops for Darfur. Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty rough situation.
But if you're the victim of, if you're the family of the Congolese girl or the girl herself or the people that were killed by the rearmed, like what was happening in the Congo is they were disarming militias and then giving them back their guns in exchange for gold. It's about as bad as it gets.
Yeah, no, it was.
If you are a victim of that,
it was a bad scandal. I guess you have to rely on these bilateral memorandums of understanding between troop contributing countries and the UN, because there's just simply not like an international framework in which to deal
one thing
with
these maybe things. I know that we're cutting the cheese a little thin here.
Yeah.
But I think this is something that it goes to the heart of some of the problems of the UN come back to, like, should it have full immunity as it currently does, right? Like, right now there's a case in Europe where relatives of victims of Srebrenica are suing the Dutch government and the UN for what happened. And it was incredible. So it was announced, and so we asked, as the press corps, asked the spokeswoman of the Ban Ki-moon, what's your take on the case? And she said, we side with the victims, we feel terrible, we hope there's justice. Mm-hmm. And then I asked, like, does that mean you're not going to try to dismiss the case? And she said, oh, we're immune.
Yeah.
So maybe, again, that's a kind of a hype case. Maybe the UN, if you allow the UN to be sued for not protecting people. But the problem is its immunity covers everything down to employee relations. I get complaints here, people that, as a kind of a muckraker, will come to me and show me real employment abuse. Like, and there's nowhere, there was a woman, I guess, that was allegedly sexually abused by the head of the refugee agency, Rod Lubbers. It's a pretty well-known case, and she had no recourse. Like, if you work for the UN, you have no recourse to the national court system of where you are. So if you're a UN employee in New York and your boss
Southern District of Manhattan Southern District Attorney have jurisdiction over these cases?
No, it was the hell one because of financial corruption. Yeah. They were able to find a way to do it.
Okay.
But literally, this woman, the woman who by all accounts was sexually harassed by the head of a UN agency, took her case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and on the grounds of immunity, the case was dismissed.
Okay.
Now, I've actually talked to a lawyer in the case
who,
he's hopeful, I mean, I don't think it'll happen. I mean, it would require a change in law, but the U.N. acts, I'm sure people have heard of the cases where, like, if a diplomat with diplomatic immunity, you want to
parking ticket cases, yes.
Right. But there was once was a murder. A guy committed a murder or a rape, and you run back to your country. There's no ability to get to the person.
I mean, I think at least, you know, I understand how people might not want to have universal jurisdiction for these crimes. I'm personally sympathetic to expanding jurisdiction of international law, like, far and wide. But, you know, I think many people in the United States are not as keen on seeing, you know, jurisdiction become universal for their own.
But in this case, it's funny. It's because it's not a matter of, like, universal jurisdiction, might, among other things, would mean if you committed war crimes in the Congo and you were in Belgium, they could pick you up and try you in Belgium.
Sure.
But in this case, we're talking about things that happened right in the city of New York.
Yeah.
But the idea is that you know, it's immune because it's an international organization.
It's like the underpinning of international diplomacy. I mean, you have, you know, like you said, you have embassy officials around the world.
You don't want people to politicize.
Employing domestic servants, who many would argue are slaves. You know, it's a terrible, you know, it's a terrible
There's a Supreme Court decision. It may even be today. It feels like it was yesterday, but it's this week, in which New York City was found able to collect some real estate taxes from the non-diplomatic portion of buildings of missions of Mongolia and India. For the legal schmiegel viewer.
Okay.
Literally, that's a big case. Mayor Bloomberg put out a press release, you know, lauding it. But I have to say this. The basis, it's like a constitutional argument that some people are coming up with, which is that nations are sovereign. This is something that pre-existed the U.S. Constitution, like sovereign immunity so that there can be diplomacy, no problem. But the U.N. came into being in, you know, 1945.
Yes.
So it comes after the Constitution. And the question is, can U.S. citizen, just, I'm not to be too pro-U.S., but can a U.S. citizen working for the U.N. be, do they lose all due process as to, like, employment, or let's say they were raped on U.N. property? Do they lose all ability to get justice through the court system because they crossed First Avenue and came onto the U.N.? Given that the UN, its immunity is really, it doesn't predate the Constitution.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, like, weird idea that's afoot.
Well, I guess, you know, it's given a status of, like, a, you know, almost a foreign embassy, you know, where you are immune. And I guess there is some value in that, but as you said, there are also some drawbacks as well.
We may be on the same page on this one. I have a sort of a hype phrase that I like to
go
use.
Go for it.
The First Amendment stops at First Avenue.
Okay.
And meaning that I've noticed that you know, not to put it down, but the protections or just the kind of ethos to First Amendment that you're going to find whether it's in Washington or New York. The government's no one's going to admit that they only accredit journalists that agree with them.
Yes.
Or that they are reading your production for content in order to decide how to treat you, right? Everyone pretends that there's some objective standard of journalism that the government doesn't get into. But here at the UN, I want to say that there's not one. The First Amendment literally does not apply.
Well, I mean, it's the United Nations is not the United States. It's not governed by the Constitution.
Oh, absolutely, I understand that.
You know?
No, but it does. I think what seems strange to some people, but it does through UNESCO, its arm that deals with cultural issues. It does preach. You know, there is a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which the UN is in charge of kind of promoting, which talks about freedom of the press. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's why I say it's a hype phrase to say the First Amendment stops at First Avenue. But there are people, and I guess I'm sort of been trying to get to this point where sometimes there's a perception that people, not that are against the UN, but that are critical and try to, like, have it live up to its standards must be either from the right or something. And I think that there is a, and I get it from here, even people that work here will say, how can we, which we preach to countries to be transparent, and we're not transparent. Mm-hmm. Or we tell people, you know, allow a free press, and yet look at what they're doing here.
Well, so, I guess this speaks to the sort of the larger issue of reforming the UN and how best to go about doing that. And that, I mean, it's obviously, like, reforming the UN is an ongoing process, but, you know, when you have, you know, all these member states each coming in with their own interests, trying to reform in a way they like, and sometimes not negotiating necessarily in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I would point to the 2005 summit outcome document, to give our readers some background here, the last huge push for UN reform came in 2005. It was supposed to be kind of Kofi Annan's big denouement. And after many, many months, almost years of painstaking negotiation, a semi-decent document on how to reform certain organs of the UN was presented, and then 3 days later, it's sad to say, Ambassador John Bolton was given his recess appointment to the UN, and he almost single-handedly torpedoed this reform process. And again, it's almost like this tragedy of UN reform is a tragedy of our own making in a way, which is pretty upsetting, I'd say.
I would say, tactically speaking,
yes,
it's strange to have, because people use the word UN reform all the time. Right now they're talking about splitting the Department of Peacekeeping in half, that's a big reform.
Yeah.
To me, it may make sense bureaucratically, but reform would be, for example, expanding the Security Council so that the five winners of World War II weren't given permanent veto rights over everything that happens 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
That would be reform.
Yes.
It's not going to happen because it would require those five to not veto the reform.
Yes.
And it's not just the U.S., by the way. I think all five would veto expansion.
Oh, sure.
But I guess the
2005 reforms, though, were not, they started as ambitious as Security Council reform, there were some management reforms, creating a new peacekeeping or a peace building commission to help stabilize post-conflict zones.
That does exist,
now exists, enshrining the responsibility to protect against governments accused of genocide, and reforming the Human Rights Council, the discredited Human Rights Commission, and making a better operation. And there's progress on all these three very important issues, but they never went sort of the whole nine yards because of obstructionism on the part of I think Bolton, and he gave and other.
I would almost say I think I've changed since I've come here, and I'll admit this. When I first started, reporting on a daily basis from the UN, I was very much like the U.S. is destroying the UN and all. I will say that within I've gotten to know a lot of the people in the U.S. mission.
Yeah.
And some of them, whether they're whatever their political affiliation, some of them honestly do believe in transparency, non-corruption.
I think their mistake
is that the U.S. is viewed so skeptically by most countries in the world that if they really wanted there to be reform of the UN, they would empower other countries like Japan and others to actually be the battering ram, the lightning rod.
Yeah.
When it's viewed as only the U.S. caring about non-corruption in UNDP, it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Because just as I think the U.S. voted against, it's like in Congress. They'll vote against a big proposal because they don't like some small part of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's true that even in a reform package, you can slip in some pork, essentially. And then the U.S. can say, we're voting against it because of the pork.
Yeah.
But I think It's tragic that the U.S., if it really wanted reform, it would do some secret diplomatic meeting with well-meaning countries and say, you know what, you lead. For example, this thing of UND, the fact that we'll go full circle back to the UNDP audit. It was beyond they weren't allowed to visit the projects they funded. And I don't want to say that's a scandal, but in reality, if you were even a foundation, if you're giving aid, you should be able to see where it goes.
Well, that's the thing.
Now,
I think it's been clear in
North Korea that you can't visit. In fact, UNICEF, I got an email from them last night. UNICEF, very well-meaning, Help the Children organization, they've suspended medical aid to two provinces in the north part of North Korea because the government said you can't come.
Yeah.
And you know why? Because this is where they're doing military experiments.
Well,
there was a mushroom cloud there.
I guess getting back to your earlier point about UN reform, I think the substance of what the United States pushes for in terms of reform is entirely correct and should be pushed for. But like you said, the tactics with which they go about trying to achieve this reform tend to undermine the cause of it.
And it makes you wonder if that's what they want.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially
when you have someone like Bolton in there smashing things up, who doesn't have necessarily a track record of wanting the UN to succeed, it makes you think that maybe there is, it makes you think that their motives are somewhat dubious, I'd say.
But you wonder, you wonder about like France and the UK.
Yeah.
These are countries that, I'll be honest with you. I've been here for some time. I've never seen the French ambassador de la Sablière or his English counterpart actually talk at all. If you ask them at a stakeout interview, you know, what, not just what about this procurement in, you know, conviction in the Southern District, basic things like, should the UN have a freedom of information policy, which is something that I ask, you know, whenever I can ask that question, I ask it, because it doesn't exist. There's no procedure. Not the U.S. Freedom of Information Act doesn't apply, no problem.
Yeah.
But should there be a procedure under which documents, you know, that, that journalists and the press would have a right to documents?
So
you can't get, these guys look at you like that's not what the UN is for.
Yeah.
I mean, some people view the UN as, they say it's an intergovernmental, it's like a club of nations. It's not, you know, it's not we the people and the human, you know. And so who cares if it's, a, it's transparent?
All right, I think we should wrap up. Let me ask you one last question.
Sure.
Who's your favorite ambassador at the UN? You got to have a favorite.
I don't want to.
Give me three.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I'm not trying to think. I don't want to. Of the P5, you basically. It's not like
anyone.
I would. Yeah, no, I'm going to go. Yeah, exactly. I believe it or not, a lot of people think he's a little drab, but I've gotten some very good explanations from the Slovakian ambassador.
What's his name or her name?
Peter Burian. And a lot of people like Ambassador Kumalo of South Africa. He gives great quotes.
Oh, yeah.
He's very funny.
He is,
but then there are people
there.
that also veto putting Myanmar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they also veto. I mean, their human rights voting record is a lot
South
to be desired.
Yeah, South Africa,
they're very open. Yeah. They're very open, and even their staff. I have to, because I mean, you talk to the ambassador, but also the staff.
Mm-hmm.
Their staff is tremendous. This guy will explain, like, here's what happened.
Yeah.
You know, here's our position. Here's where it's going. So
yeah.
I have to give Matt. You know, they've been a real. Right now, they're on the Security Council.
Yes.
Although a lot of people criticize, you know, their actual votes. They do bring a level of sort of transparency and kind of like, there's the beef. Because it really is fun, you know, I'll tell you, one time I was covering it was a vote either on Iran or Lebanon, some big picture item. And they're in the chamber, they're negotiating the ins and outs of a resolution. And the ambassador of Greece comes out to where I'm sitting with my laptop in this kind of waiting area. There's a sandwich machine. You put in $5 and it turns around and you pull the sandwich out of the machine.
Yeah.
And he puts in his money and he turns it and he opens up an empty box and he closes it. Now he tries again. Then he turns it again and he tries to open the one with the sandwich in it, but it won't open. And he sits there for like 10 minutes trying to get the sandwich out of the box. And I go to him and I say, like, yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. You've already spent your money. It was on an empty box, but... And meanwhile, the negotiation's going on, you know? So I, like, said to him, like, you know, maybe you should bring it up in the council. Because he was like, I've got to get a refund. I'm not trying to... I mean, to me, the message of the story is not that... He was also a very well-liked ambassador. He's a very... It's just that the opinions, even of countries on the Security Council, if they're not in the Permanent Five... It makes no difference. They don't need their votes. They don't consult with them, and it's disrespectful. And you know, whatever.
Yeah. All right. Well, Matthew Lee, InterCity Press.
Sure.
Mark Goldberg, Sandwich. UN Dispatch, and the American Prospect. And thanks.
No, definitely, it was fun.
All right.
You know.
Yeah, let's do this again sometime.
Okay.
All right. See you.